in Lesson 13, we talk about the Renaissance Prepper, which occurred in the 1200 to 1680 period. This entire story, as it unfolds beyond the apostles, is one of almost continuously increasing momentum. By 1200 AD, all of Europe, southern, middle, and northern, had gained a common written language, Latin. That link existed very specifically due to the Christian faith. That faith was the Roman formulation, the earthen vessel, in which the treasure of biblical faith was precariously carried. The Roman earthen vessel would not forever dominate Europe, but it did last long enough to give it a single language that endured as a vehicle of scholarship many centuries after the somewhat superficial unity it had created ended. Many new and unprecedented events emerged, which together defined the increasing momentum. We saw in the last lesson how the final years of the 800 to 1200 period were bursting with new vitality. The first appearance of universities, cathedrals, crusades, and above all the new pattern, the friars. Still other evidences of mounting vitality, such as the emergence of the Albigenses, the Cathari, and the Waldensians, were brutally crushed. At the same time, the most powerful pope of all time, Innocent III, was able to excommunicate rulers and interdict whole countries in order to establish morality and justice as he saw it. But moving into the 1200 to 1600 period, the friars, the Franciscans, and the Dominicans very soon became a truly major additional force. Not politically, militarily, or at first even ecclesiastically, but spiritually. Within a few years, there were 60,000 followers of Francis. Their evangelists blanketed and greened Europe, and thus the 12th century Renaissance flowed over into the next period. We read in Paulus Sharpe's History of Evangelism, the foreword was written by Billy Graham, of a, quote, Whitehead of the 13th century, unquote, and of the widespread preaching of justification by faith. The emergence of the friars could well have been the most important event as we enter the 1200 and 1600 period. This was also the period in which the Black Plague took the lives of one-third of the people in Europe. It is believed that 20,000 Franciscans, as well as many others, of course, died in Germany alone because they intentionally, despite the known risk, tended the sick. There was also this curious and amazing phenomenon of the Crusades. While they began in the previous period, they caused much of their disturbance in our own period. On the one hand, they certainly reflected the increasing momentum of both civilization and the official Christian faith in the West. Some were launched as a direct result of sweeping spiritual revivals. On the other hand, they betrayed the still savage background of the majority of the now Christianized Goths and Vikings. The Crusades were a combination of prayerful, dedicated believers and crude adventurers. All of them were led by former Vikings. At this stage, the Islamic tradition was, by comparison, much more civilized than the Middle and Northern European Christians. If a crusader went out of his mind in a military venture, the common method of remedy would be to gouge a cross in his scalp and pour molten lead into it. By contrast, the Muslims possessed far more sophisticated understandings of physical and mental illness, as well as literature, science, philosophy, and political science. In the 14th century, a leading Christian library north of the Alps might have 400 books in it, while an Islamic library down in Cordova, Spain, had 400,000 books. Meanwhile, there was also the comparative magnificence of the Chinese civilization under the Mongol Emperor Kublai Khan, as reported by Marco Polo. Marco Polo's father and uncle had been in his court earlier. The Khan, whose mother was a Nestorian Christian, asked them to relay to the Pope his request for 100 missionaries who could teach science and theology. After delivering this amazing message to the Pope, the two brothers returned to Europe, now with the 15-year-old Marco, they were able to recruit only two Dominicans who turned back when things got scary. However, they did arrive. Marco Polo, who was favored by Kublai Khan, stayed in China 17 years, working closely with the emperor. He later wrote up his experiences back in Europe. He was most surprised by the Mongols' use of paper money, coal for heating, not just wood, and a postal system which was something like the Pony Express, which functioned briefly in the American expansion of the West. Just before 1300, a Dominican finally arrived in the court, but after the death of Kublai Khan, just before 1300 AD, a Dominican finally arrived in the court, but this was after the death of Kublai Khan. Despite the intense opposition of the Nestorians who were already there, he did gain a following of some 6,000. The general acceleration of things was vastly spurred on by one of the side effects of the Crusades, greater acquaintance with the Greek and Roman classical world, over which, by this date, the Muslims were the main custodians. This rebirth of the classics gave the general name Renaissance to a period that, in fact, was actually less of a Renaissance than either of what the scholars referred to as the Carolingian Renaissance or the 12th century Renaissance in these two earlier periods. These earlier Renaissances, and I would add what I have dubbed the Classical Renaissance of the 4th century, more profoundly affected society than did the Renaissance of the 15th century, which involved mainly artists and scholars. The Wikipedia states, historians now point out that most of the negative social factors popularly associated with the medieval period, poverty, ignorance, warfare, religious and political persecution, and so forth, seem to have actually worsened during this age of Machiavelli, the wars of religion, the corrupt Borgia popes, and the intensified witch hunts of the 16th century. Many of the common people who lived during the so-called Renaissance were known to have been concerned by the developments of the era rather than viewing them as a golden age, which was imagined by certain 19th century authors. Perhaps the most important factor of the Renaissance is that those involved in the cultural movements in question, that is to say, the artists, rulers, and their patrons, believed that they were living in a new era that was a clean break from the Middle Ages, even if much of the rest of the population seems to have viewed the period as an intensification of social maladies. And so ends the quote from Wikipedia. The most reasonable conclusion would seem to be to extend the usual meaning of the Renaissance to include the Reformation of the 16th century, with an emphasis on the Gutenberg printing revolution in the 1450s and the many children of the printing revolution in the following century. Within 50 years of Gutenberg, 1,000 printers emerged, and by Luther's day, in the early 1500s, 3 million printed documents had been produced, 3/4 of them religious. Thus, what started out as a Renaissance involving only a few became a Reformation more profoundly affecting the entire area of European society than any previous event. Interestingly, the term Reformation is not entirely accurate. It implies a reformation or an improvement of theological and moral patterns, when in fact it is much more easily understood as a final breakdown of an essentially temporary and superficial extension of Mediterranean culture and theology up into Northern Europe. It is basically an example of the breakaway of a mission field church, in this case the Germanic culture. It is one more case of the earthen vessel of the missionary culture finally yielding to the new earthen vessel of a new missionized cultural sphere. The Reformation was by no means primarily a theological squabble over the doctrine of the justification by faith. A cultural religious reformation would be a better phrase. For example, John Wycliffe is called the morning star of the Reformation. His vernacular English translation of the Bible, centuries earlier, is said to be to epitomize the threat of the Reformation and to emphasize the issue of the suppression of the Bible, and especially the Bible in the vernacular of the various language groups of Europe. In reality, for Wycliffe and later John Huss, it was not so much the case that the Bible would not be in languages other than Latin, but whether or not the Bible was more authoritative than the Pope. Even that was not at bottom the real problem, but the fact that elevating the authority of the Bible freed outlying communities from the cultural and political domination of the Pope and his Latin Church. Luther gained great indignation against all things Roman simply because of a routine visit to Rome on behalf of his order. Even had that not happened, the breakdown of the uniformitarian principle on which the papacy stood would have undoubtedly happened. In any case, we would merely have not heard of Luther. His trip to the stinking city of Rome and its multitudinous tourist traps for naive Christian visitors changed him from a Christian German to a German Christian. Next, money raising by Rome, promising contributors things after death, further troubled Luther. His posting, he didn't really nail it on a bulletin board, he just had posted it there, of items for routine discussion, the so-called 99 Theses, has to be sure highlighted the theological features of the Reformation. But those things he also wrote about to the current Pope, with no great difference of opinion. The Pope was one of the best of the popes. He favored the Elector Frederick, who was the senator from Luther's region, as the best candidate to become the new emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And until that issue of the choice of a new emperor was decided, no one in Rome was eager to work against Luther, which gave him 25 years of freedom. For far from being an issue over the translation of the Bible into the vernacular, Luther's translation into the vernacular was the 14th entire Bible rendered into German. In Italy, Spain, France, and Germany, hundreds of small groups were studying the Bible and believing in justification by faith. Only when it became clear that the Bible in the vernacular could be employed for divisive political purposes was it necessary for both Protestants and Catholics to restrict the reading of the Bible to scholars. Both camps burned Bibles in unofficial translations. A proper reading of the Book of Acts could have allowed for a peaceful diversity of insider movements within the various cultures over which the Latin Church had extended its reach. Why, for example, should Mediterranean respect for celibacy be extended into Germanic territory, which had no such respect? Had the Reformation been merely a matter of doctrinal reformation, the Lutheran revolt would not have spread automatically to all the territories beyond which the Roman Empire had not thoroughly Romanized the cultural substratum, as had been the case, for example, in France, Spain, and Italy. There would seem to be two exceptions to the rule that the Reformation succeeded where the Romans had not succeeded. In both Poland and Ireland, we see outlying groups who deliberately stayed Roman in order to distinguish themselves from the peoples in between that had gone Protestant and who were geographically separate from Rome. Of course, the Roman domination of much of Europe for centuries created a tension leading to half-hearted loyalty to the Reformation and considerable hesitation and confusion. To this day, villages in German side one way or another and post the percentage breakdown of Catholic or Lutheran at the edge of the town as you drive in. However, for at least a century, such differences led to innumerable armed conflicts such as endure in Northern Ireland, which goes back to the Celtic Anglo-Saxon tension long before the Reformation. This perspective I am giving you is missiological, It would seem to aid enormously in modern attempts to decipher the complexity of global Christianity. The same word Reformation is often mentioned when a radical change of earthen vessels takes place, both at home and in the so-called mission lands. But it is uncommon to hear of the significant parallels between the transmission of biblical faith from Jewish to Greek and Latin worlds and the transmission of biblical faith from either Greek or Latin to several other worlds farther north, and the transmission of biblical faith from Western Christianity to forms of the faith that prefer not to adopt Western culture at all, along with a treasure that always comes to them in such earthen vessels. There are other parallels. Islam can be seen as a transmission of biblical faith from a Roman to a Semitic earthen vessel. Islam is, unfortunately, blighted by the simple fact, as we've already seen, that the form of faith from which Muslims drew their cues was itself a highly defective Christianity. One insightful scholar, for this reason, has said that Islam is a victim of flawed Christianity. Furthermore, the Bible in its entirety was not available in Arabic. Other parallels thus can be seen all over the mission world. That is, cases where the Bible becomes available and a considerable number of people prefer to interpret it for themselves instead of accepting the missionary's culturally laden interpretation. Even in American history, we can perceive what H. Richard Niebuhr's book, Social Sources of Denominationalism, famously points out, that denominations are basically more often different cultural streams than they are theologically disagreements. The beginning of global missions is to be seen in the later years of this period, due to the ability to circumnavigate the globe. It is for Protestants a matter of acute embarrassment, however, that the beginning of global missions is almost entirely a Catholic event. Ample coverage of this significant beginning is contained in the reading assignment for this lesson.